In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, September 15th, 2014. And this right here is a listener-inspired episode. I'll explain just how in a minute when I bring on my guest, Lou Rockwell, of the indispensable website lourockwell.com, which Ron Paul reads first thing every morning. Of course, Lou is also the founder and chairman of the Ludwig von Mises Institute over at Mises.org, which did more than any other institution to make me who I am today. So you can either cheer them or blame them for that, depending on how you feel about me. Before I bring Lou on, let me just tell you guys that finally, two of the homeschool courses I'm preparing for RonPaulHomeschool.com are now available to get from me directly. Some people have said, I don't want to join the whole Ron Paul program. I just want what you're producing. And these courses, by the way, are not just for high school students. Any adult can take them and you will not feel talked down to. But they are Western Civilization to 1492. So from the ancient world all the way up to 1492. Huge amount of material covered in 180 videos and audio files, depending on how you prefer to consume them. And my government course, 90 video files or audio files. These things are now available to get just from me at TomWoodsHomeschool.com. But the much cooler way to get them is to get them as part of the Tom Woods Bag of Goodies, which you can get as part of my Supporting Listeners program at SupportingListeners.com. That thing has been revamped, updated. You get so many things now, depending on what level you're at. It's unbelievable. So I'm just calling it the Tom Woods Bag of Goodies. And if you want to get those courses, you want to learn some of that stuff, you want to feel knowledgeable where you feel weak, you want to fill in some gaps in your knowledge, whatever it is, you want to not waste time when you're on your commute, great. Well, the most fun way to get these courses and to get a whole bunch of other things I have for you guys is to get them through the Tom Woods Bag of Goodies over at SupportingListeners.com. Now, when you go over there, you won't see the words Tom Woods Bag of Goodies because I'm too embarrassed to put that phrase up there. But I'll say it, I just won't write it down. So anyway, check out the Tom Woods Bag of Goodies, SupportingListeners.com. That's enough of that. I'll talk to you a little bit more about that at the end of my conversation with Lou Rockwell, whom I would like to bring onto the program right now. Lou, welcome back to the show.
Tom, great to be with you, as always.
Lou, I told you today when I called that somebody had written to me, listener of the show, who said, you should think about doing a show highlighting Rothbard's work Conceived in Liberty, which was a four-volume history of colonial America up through the 1780s, really, late 1770s. And now the Mises Institute has it in a giant single volume. And I thought, yeah, that is an important book, and people should know more about it. But then I thought, before I start doing shows like that, I think we need the Rothbard Overview show. And believe it or not, a year into this show, we have no Rothbard Overview show. And I thought, well, who better in the world to come on here and talk to about Murray than somebody who knew him as well as you did and worked as closely with him as you did? So I thought, Lou Rockwell, and I picked up the phone and I asked if you'd do it, and then I very sheepishly asked if you'd consider doing it today, and you agreed. So before we get into the weeds of this, let's look at the overall picture. In 2 minutes or less, why is Rothbard important to begin with?
Well, Rothbard is important for a couple of reasons. First of all, because he was such a significant scholar, as an economist, as an historian, as a political philosopher. He was an original thinker and a very compelling thinker, a man who created, among other things, modern libertarianism by combining 19th century American anarchism and Austrian economics and natural law based in Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas. And really, it's a durable and fascinating philosophy. It explains what we need to be concerned about, in a sense, it explains how to proceed. It's extremely compelling. Everything of Rothbard's was compelling. Speaking to the people listening to us, if you haven't read Rothbard, just pick up anything by Murray, and it's all for free online at Mises.org. And also, there's a lot at LouRockwell.com as well. Just take a look at any essay of Murray's, let's say The Anatomy of the State, which is one of his famous essays. You're immediately pulled into it. He's so clear. He's so logical. He's so persuasive. You'll never be the same again. I mean, this is true of many, many of Rothbard's works. They really are life-changing. So he had this based on the immense knowledge that he had. And this was somebody, so far as I could tell, who knew everything. Now, of course, I'm exaggerating, but only slightly. In the areas that he was interested in, he pretty much knew everything. Such deep and well-analyzed and rigorous knowledge. You've read everything. He had remembered everything. If you were in his apartment, which was full of books, almost humorously full of books, and you were asking Murray a question, he'd say, that's covered in that particular book on that shelf. There it is, the third one from the left, chapter 3 and pages 29 through 36. I mean, he had that kind of knowledge, yet he was a humble guy, not at all arrogant, one of the most charming people you could ever meet, extremely funny. He was like a stand-up comedian in addition to all his scholarly abilities and his teaching abilities. Very charming, very welcoming, never put down students. I think of him as contrast to Milton Friedman, who was a brilliant guy too, but was famous for humiliating a student who asked a question Friedman either thought was stupid or he didn't like the question for whatever reason. Rothbard was never like that. He was just a great human being, as well as just, I think, no question, one of the extraordinary men of the 20th century. Maybe we'll in the future become to be seen as an extraordinary figure over a much broader time span.
Now, before we get into the overview of his life, I want to say something before I forget about Rothbard that I don't think I've ever said, which is that when you look at what he was engaged in doing in his scholarly work, as opposed to the popular articles he would write for various periodicals, but when you look at his scholarly work, he could write scholarly work that was respected by the academic community. For example, his book The Panic of 1819 got very, very good reviews in the professional journals, published by Columbia University Press. Great. But a lot of the rest of his scholarly work, like Man, Economy, and State, or his, The Ethics of Liberty, a lot of this stuff, he knew for a fact there would be no academic audience for it. If there were, it would be only an audience that would condemn him. There's no popular audience for this scholarly work either. So who's he writing this for then? And the answer is he can only be writing for posterity, and I suppose to a lesser degree just for himself, for the sake of the ideas. I mean, he did this knowing full well he's not going to be appointed chairman of the economics department at Harvard. He's already been purged from National Review, so libertarian economic ideas are not going to be, or at least his name expressing those ideas is not going to be welcome in that magazine. And yet he kept on churning out an enormous amount of output without getting the commensurate reward. And he kept on doing it and kept on doing it. Today, you and I have instant gratification. We write an essay, it goes up on the internet the next day, people write you emails telling you how great you are. He didn't have that kind of feedback. He didn't have that kind of audience. He didn't have that kind of technology. And look what he produced.
Well, he really was such an extraordinary guy. And, of course, he enjoyed money. He loved buying books, for example. But money was not the chief motivator in his life. Of course, this is one of the ways in which Austrian economics differs from mainstream economics. We don't think of man as homo economicus. There are other things that motivate people besides money, although, again, money's a great thing. It's necessary. So Murray was taught for a very long time at a very minor school in New York, Brooklyn Polytechnic, only getting a job there because he was such an expert exponent of the case against the Vietnam War. Of course, like everything else Murray got interested in, he knew everything about it. He knew everything about the history of Vietnam, the previous interventions, all the people who were important on the North Vietnamese side, the Viet Cong, the South Vietnamese, the American government, the French government, and so forth. And they were so impressed by him that he felt they sort of either overlooked or didn't really care about his other views. Later, when they realized what his other views were, they never would have hired him because it was pretty much a left-wing outfit. He made, at the height of his income there at Brooklyn Polytechnic, $26,000 a year. So he never had much money, exactly like Mises famously when he asked the woman who was going to be his wife, Margaret, to marry him. He said, "I just want to warn you, I'm going to write much about money. I'm not going to have much of it."
There you go. That's exactly
so
right.
So Murray could have said exactly the same thing to his wife of so many years, Joey Rothbard. But, you know, he was really the pure scholar, the pure teacher. And yes, I think it was for himself, but it absolutely was for the future. And he was so happy to get anybody interested, just the least little spark of intelligence and interest in something, he would just do his best to fan the flames. And but he was writing for the sake of truth, of telling the truth. That this by itself has a we might say an eternal application, certainly a very long term application on Earth. So that was Murray, and from the very earliest days he was a star. I was telling you earlier, Bill White, who now passed away, but was a lifelong friend of Murray's, and was in Birchwathen School, which was the private school that Murray went to. Starting in the third grade, when the principal of the public elementary school he was at told his parents, "This boy does not belong in a public school." Very unusual comment coming, of course, from a public school administrator. "He's far too smart. He's far too significant. He needs to go to a private school." So Bill said that he first heard of Murray Rothbard in the third grade when his mother came home and said, she just had a conference with the headmaster, and she said, "Why can't you be like that boy Murray Rothbard?" You know, the headmaster told me he had never in his whole life encountered a student of this significance. This is Murray in the third grade. So we were lucky enough at the Mises Institute to have all of Murray's papers. And when you look at his early, even elementary school papers, he's clearly Murray Rothbard. I mean, he was a star all through school. He went to Columbia University. He studied economics and math. For his bachelor's degree, and of course, you know, summa cum laude, and all throughout, you know, master's in economics, PhD in economics. He was held back for many years from actually being granted the PhD because the evil Arthur Burns, who later became chairman of the economic advisors under Nixon, and then head of the Fed, under Eisenhower, and then head of the Fed under Nixon, blocked him from getting the PhD, blocked it from being considered, even though he was not even on Murray's committee, but he was of such prominence in the economics department that he could stop the process. But so it was very, 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 very tough for Murray. Thank goodness Burns, maybe not for the world, but for Murray's sake anyway, got wafted away to Washington by Eisenhower. Murray got the PhD.
Yeah, let me jump in on that PhD point, because as if to underscore how petty that was by Burns is the fact that Murray's dissertation, which he later published as a book with Columbia University Press, for heaven's sake, was renowned in the scholarly journals. So it was viewed as a significant contribution to U.S. economic history. So Burns
still
is
a standard
being
work.
Petty. Yeah, everybody. No one writes about the Panic of 1819 anymore because Rothbard is in the mainstream considered to have written the definitive work. So Burns, we're not just making this up. This isn't just sour grapes. That is verifiably pettiness on his part.
I always remember Murray saying that Arthur Burns sounded like W.C. Fields without the humor. He had the same voice as W.C. Fields. So Murray was late in getting his Ph.D., couldn't get a job because of, despite his brilliance and his abilities in so many different areas, because of his views. But there was an organization then called the Volcker Fund, now no longer in existence, a great libertarian foundation, and they hired Murray to read books, to read the significant books in the social sciences that either they thought were significant or that he thought were significant. and write reports on them. And we've published some of these reports. Many, many of them are still unpublished. They will be published someday. So he had an extraordinary time intellectually doing this, just being paid to read all the important books that he was interested in. But it was a while before he was able to get a job again at Brooklyn Polytechnic. But nothing stopped him. I mean, he was so optimistic. He was always full of hope, always looking for the best side of things. Again, so funny, so passionate, so learned. By the way, anything he was interested in, he knew everything about. For example, he was very interested in the Olympics. So when every 4 years when the Olympics would come up, he knew all the athletes, all the records, the history of the teams, and so he just, you know, or if you, he loved politics. He never voted, of course. He was too smart for that. But he loved politics. So you could talk to Murray, and especially the night of the election, or the night before the election, and you'd say, Murray, what's happening in, you know, the second district of New York in Buffalo? He would know the candidates, the issues. He'd have a prediction about what was going to happen and all the significant interest groups. He was a genius. What can I say? I mean, he was an unbelievable genius, and we were so lucky to have him on our side because of all these great works that he published, which again are so compelling. And everything's again for free on Mises.org. His essays, thousands of popular articles, all these important books, everything's there. And I once had a little fight with a guy from the Cato Institute who had written an article for The Economist about the Ron Paul movement. And he said, you know, the Ron Paul movement really is attracting young people. Got to give him a lot of credit for that. But there's a terrible failing at the heart of the Ron Paul movement. He said, they're Rothbardian. Really, they should be Friedmanites. So I blogged this, and I said, I happen to think this is a matter of that it's just that it is Rothbardian, because I happen to think that Murray was right and Friedman was wrong in a lot of ways, although right in some ways. But I said, I thought that today Murray must be, if not the one of the best known economists in the whole world. Among regular people and even among students, that Friedman was not well known anymore. His books were still significant to academic economists in many different ways, but he just wasn't the figure he had been, even though he lived much longer than Murray, almost 30 years longer than Murray did. Murray died much too young. But so poor David Friedman, I like David Friedman, he got very upset at this, and he was criticizing it on his blog, and one of the commenters said, you know, this is a very unfair thing, Rockwell was saying. You can't make this comparison. All of Rothbard is available for free on Mises.org, and Friedman's books are not online, and they're very expensive. So he said, of course Rothbard's better known than Friedman, and really it's unfair. You know, you can't make this. So I thought, yeah, unfair, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so
right.
So it's Murray is much better known today than he was during his lifetime. If he were still alive today, and he could easily still be alive today with a longer lifespan and not an unusually long lifespan, he would be much better known in terms of, he'd be known as, for example, the greatest anti-war intellectual in the world, the most prolific, the most eloquent, the most interesting, who knew every, you know, whether we're talking about the wars that are going on now or the past wars, he knew everything about them.
Yeah, Lou, I'm telling you, the Mises Institute would have published the Rothbard podcast every day. You call him up on the phone, he doesn't have to know any of the technology. And you talk to him, you let him talk for 20 minutes a day, that would get 250,000 downloads per episode. Well, you know, without a doubt, just like that. You know, and I mean, you know, in a way, Lou, I hate these contrary to fact scenarios because they make me sad to think about them.
Well, it is very sad, and all we can do is be grateful that we had Murray as long as we did. And I remember one great incident during Mises University, when you, the first Mises University you went to, and you were interested in talking to Murray, and you met Murray, and I noticed you two talking away in very animated fashion. This is when you were still a student. And so I came back hours later, came back by that particular area hours later, and you two were still just chattering away at full speed. I thought, that is so great. I thought Tom's life is going to be changed.
It was. It absolutely was. Absolutely was. I mean, and by the way, talk about a guy. You know, when we talk about Ron Paul, we say he's the same guy in private life that he appears to be in public life. Well, when you see a Rothbard speech and he's animated and funny, that is also who he is, one-on-one. Yeah. Exactly right. Now, let me throw something in terms of his academic career. Joe Salerno completely convinced me of this in a talk he gave some time ago about the significance of the book Man, Economy, and State, which was Rothbard's major economic treatise. It runs 1,000 pages, even if you don't include the section that was considered too radical to include in the first edition, the Power and Market section. It's an enormous contribution. It is it's sweeping. It is steeped in the mainstream economics literature, and it is, according to Joe, the key missing link between Mises and the South Royalton Conference. There was a famous conference in 1974 among the small remnant of Austrian economists who could still be found. And Joe showed that basically everybody at that conference had been influenced by and kept going within the Austrian tradition by Man, Economy, and State. That Rothbard had basically kept the flame going during the worst period for the Austrian school in the 20th century.
And you know, it's interesting. Mises was not known as an effusive guy, and when he even when he was praising some work that he thought highly of, he was not effusive. But his review of Man, Economy, and State, which you can find on Mises.org, is very, very favorable. I mean, just extraordinarily favorable. Of course, I think appropriately favorable. So Mises thought the world of this book, which it's, this is sort of a, applies to other areas of Murray's work. He was hired to do a short book that would turn human action, Mises's great magnum opus, into a textbook. Well, it's like when Murray was asked to do a little book on the American Revolution, and he ended up doing Conceived in Liberty. It's, you know, four large volumes.
Right.
So Murray never was satisfied. He started out like that, but he wasn't satisfied with that. He did something that in some ways improved human action, although he would be the first to say that human action was the necessary foundation for him. So this BS book to this day, and it's widely used all over the world, widely read. It's been translated into Chinese, for example, been translated into Russian, all these former communist countries, many, many different languages, the Mises Institutes all over the world, and just the interest, growing interest in the Austrian school and in Murray Rothbard have made this book so much better known, so much better read than it was in Murray's lifetime. But he was, he wasn't discouraged. He was so thrilled to find a publisher for this work, and that anybody was interested in it. He was just interested in just one person, two people. He was happy to talk to anyone in any circumstance if they had any interest in the kinds of ideas that he espoused and the scholarly areas that he was such an expert in, even if you were far below his level, and let's put it this way, very few of us came anywhere near Rothbard's level. But he just was such a charming guy, such a humble guy, such a polite and kind, such a wonderful person. I can tell you, anybody listening to this show, if you had met Murray Rothbard, there's nobody you would rather have a drink with. I mean, he just was the most interesting, funny companion. If he was in a room, everybody gravitated to him. He had star power, even though he, he was, Walter Block describes him as a little short, partially bald Jewish guy. Well, yeah, that's right. But it didn't matter that he didn't look like John Galt or whatever.
Right, right.
He was magnetic. And just those of us who were lucky to know him lucky is not quite the word. We were blessed to know him. And he is the center of I would say, the Austrian movement. He's the center of libertarianism and of what he calls anarcho-capitalism. He's just having such extraordinary power all over the world. I just, of course, wish every day, I miss him every day, still after all these years. And I wish so much he were here just to enjoy it, as well as, you say, to have talk on the radio or just any. He would have loved the internet. He was not exactly Mr. High Tech. He once, Ronald, he could never get the, I don't know if people are going to remember the ancient days of VCRs, but he could never get the little clock to stop flashing on his VCR.
Oh.
And Ronald Hamaway, great historian, friend of Murray's, was over at the house once and fixed that. And forever after, Murray thought Ronald as being like Mr. High Tech. I mean, that he was a brilliant tech guy. Ronald was not a brilliant tech guy. But he tells, by the way, a wonderful story about Murray's generosity. Even though he did not join in work, and he made a very small income, and yet they would open their home. It was really the libertarian salon of its day. And Ronald said, it never struck me at the time how generous they were, for example, with drinks. And he said, I only realized some years later they couldn't really afford it. But they were so generous. Their hospitality is famous. And anybody who has ever had the opportunity to have dinner with Murray and Joey or have a drink, be just in the room, so warm, just such sweet people. Joey, by the way, herself brilliant. I mean, Margaret von Mises always used to say she should have gotten her PhD. Well, she definitely was capable of getting a PhD. Mm-hmm. She had a master's from Columbia, but she was an expert on Wagnerian opera and many. I mean, when I say an expert, I mean a genuine expert. Of course, she learned German, and so they were just an extraordinary couple. As well as Murray just being such a great person. And he wrote all the time. He wrote all night. It was nothing but our nights. I mean, he would sleep at maybe go to sleep at maybe 2 in the morning, or maybe he'd work till 6 in the morning. He worked all night. He wrote every night. And sometimes I'd get, this is back in the days of the fax machine, I'd get to the office, there'd be a 20-page article that Murray had written overnight. These were typically popular articles about the evil of George H.W. Bush and then the Iraq War.
Right, right. But with a ton of history and stuff in it. By the way, is this story true that in the middle of the night one time he woke up Joey and said, that bastard Eli Whitney didn't invent the cotton gin after all? Or did somebody make that up?
Yeah, so Joey was asleep, and he didn't, you know, it was his. He said, "Plan that yes." So yeah, he was reading and he was passionate, funny, and had a very contagious and distinctive laugh. Joey talked about when they were dating once, and they were supposed to go to the movies, and she was late getting there, and theater's dark, big New York theater, and all of a sudden she hears Murray laughing, and there was nobody who had a laugh like Murray's. So she could go, you know, just like a beeline, right, to find him in the
theater.
Yeah,
in the dark. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Because of his laugh.
All right. I do want to get to, before we let you go, I do want to get to where should people begin with his work. But before that, I want to ask you something that I don't know about, and that is, I think it was 1986 that he left Brooklyn Polytechnic to go teach at UNLV, and his title was S.J. Hall Distinguished Professor of Economics at UNLV. So I presume that was an endowed chair. So can you tell us who was S.J. Hall and how did this all work out? Was this somebody who liked Murray and then put up the money for him to be employed there? Was this an existing endowment already and Murray just applied for it? How did he come into that?
Well, S.J. Hall was a timber magnate in Nevada. He had passed away by the time Murray was out there. His widow had endowed a visiting chair. Originally, it was for bring a new professor. Each year, there have been several others. When Murray came and it shows what the department and the dean and so forth was like in those days. They couldn't believe they had this guy at their school.
Right.
And they turned, with Mrs. Hall's permission, the visiting professorship into a permanent endowed professorship. And really, it was the greatest academic experience of Murray's life. He still didn't have PhD students. He never had PhD students, a great tragedy. But it was so much better than Brooklyn Poly, which he once described to me as an engineering school where the elevators never worked. And he once talked about poor Mises teaching a bunch of uncomprehending packaging majors. Well, Murray, I'm sorry to say, pretty much had a bunch of uncomprehending engineering students in his classes. And by the way, that never stopped him. I mean, he didn't slough off. He was always interesting, fascinating as a teacher, because I know people who visited his class there, Hans Hermann Hoppe, for example, when he first came to this country, attended Murray's classes. It was like, you know, he was talking to a graduate seminar at Harvard or whatever. I mean, he always put his all into his teaching, and same at UNLV. So all of a sudden he had a decent salary for the first time. He and Joey got a home in Las Vegas. Murray loved Las Vegas because he said it was a night city. Everything was open all night.
Yeah.
You could drop off your dry cleaning at 3 a.m. Thought it was, you know, that it was just a civilized city in that way. But it was really the man who was the chairman of the department, other members of the faculty, I think not being influenced by maybe the normal academic attitudes to somebody like Murray, but they just realized they had a gem and they wanted to keep him. And thank goodness that worked out. Later on, the sort of typical things that happened at universities happened there. They ended up with a Marxist dean. They ended up with a Marxist chairman of the department, and they did everything they could. By this time, Murray had been successful in bringing Hans Hermann Hoppe out there. So these guys did everything possible they could to circumscribe them and to hurt them and so forth. But Murray just kept going, and he was always famous for being a great colleague. I mean, that was true at Brooklyn Poly and certainly true at UNLV. Even people who didn't like him politically or from an academic theoretical standpoint loved him as a person. And he was wonderful in faculty meetings. He was, you know, he was in the university reading clubs and the cooking clubs and all that sort of thing. And he loved people. People loved him. And he was just a great guy. But that was a wonderful moment in Murray's life when the S.J. Hall professorship became available to him and then was transformed into a permanent tenure job where he taught for the rest of his life.
All right. I have never heard that story told before, so I'm very, very glad I asked. Maybe, I don't know, maybe this is the first time people hear about it on the internet. I don't know, but I was interested in that. Where would you recommend people get started? There's so much to jump into. Where should they start with Rothbard, would you say? I mean, there are a handful of titles you would say are just the obvious starting points?
Well, you're going to link to an article of mine about reading Rothbard.
Right, yep.
Which gives some advice about this. I'd start with some of an economics student, it's going to be slightly different than if you're a history student or you're just somebody interested in these ideas. But I think I mentioned earlier his essay, The Anatomy of the State. It's a life-changing essay, and it's nothing you have to make yourself read. You start it, and you'll be amazed by it. So I would start there. So many of his shorter works, The Anatomy of the Fed, What Has Government Done to Our Money, these are all very significant books, even though they're short. There's a little bit bigger book called The Mystery of Banking, which is a tremendous explanation of what's wrong with the banking system and how a proper banking system would work. And, of course, we live today even more than in Murray's time in sort of a bankocracy. I mean, the big banks, whether in Europe or in this country, are really ruling the roost, and many terrible things happen as a result of that. Murray explained them all. If you're interested in American history, you mentioned Conceived in Liberty. There's his two-volume History of Thought that carries us up only through Marx. Tragically, the third volume, which Joey, when I remember asking Joey Rothbard after his death, I said, whether did Murray leave any notes for the third volume? She said, no, he'd already written it, but it was all in his head. Yeah. And Murray, that's the way Murray wrote books. He wrote them in his head.
Yeah, but,
and so
but doggone
it. Was
just
pretty much transcription.
I know. I wish he hadn't done it that way, though, so that we'd have those darn notes.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the great unwritten book, because, my gosh, could you imagine? I bet you the sections on Keynes. See, the history of thought itself is another example of what you were talking about before, of what had started off as a small-scale project, a free market version of The Worldly Philosophers by Heilbronner.
Right.
So maybe a 300-page book, and it turned into, well, in his lifetime, two giant volumes, would have been a third volume. Well, I think there would have been a volume within a volume. I think the Keynes stuff could easily have been extracted into a separate book. You know, I mean, he wouldn't have been able to stop himself once he got to Keynes. There would have been such good stuff. But thankfully, he left such a legacy in terms of all these students who have learned from him, faculty who have learned from him, that now we have to carry on and fill in the gaps that he left. He didn't leave a lot of gaps, but he did leave some to be a sport so that we'd all have something to do. So, Lou, as you say, I am going to link to the Reed Rothbard thing, which pretty much goes through his main, through his books. But then, as you say, there are great essays and articles. The book Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature and Other Essays is a great collection. I think The Anatomy of the State may first have appeared or may have appeared there, but every one of those essays is great Rothbard. It's scholarly to a degree, but punchy as well. So I think that's my favorite style.
And talk about timely for our days.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, this has been great. I mean, of course, we could just go on forever, but I hope this has given people a taste of why there was this attraction to this man, why it continues to exist, why it even continues to grow. And nobody has done more to preserve it and carry it on than the Mises Institute and LouRockwell.com, Mises.org and LouRockwell.com. So I appreciate that and your time today, Lou. Thanks a lot.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, everybody, a couple quick things before we get going. At the supportinglisteners.com site, you'll find not just my homeschool courses, but you'll find all kinds of neat discounts. You'll be able to get the Kindle version of my forthcoming book, Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. I've got exclusive mini courses for some of you guys who are supporting listeners on different subjects. I've got one on the Great Depression and the New Deal that I did with Bob Murphy. I've got one on what are the differences between the Austrian and Chicago schools of economics. Whole bunch of neat things, plus free books, and I'm just throwing stuff at you. So go over there and pick out which Tom Woods bag of goodies you want at supportinglisteners.com, and you are helping me keep the lights on and keep this thing going. My next public appearance will be at Liberty Fest in New York City. Get the details on that. It's going to be October 11th, 2014. It's going to be at lfnyc.com. That's LF for Liberty Fest, NYC for New York City. lfnyc.com. You can get 50% off tickets with coupon code WOODS, I believe. And if you want to be a sponsor, if you want to get your message out to a group of Liberty people, they are looking for sponsorships of this event. So again, check that out at lfnyc.com. All right, everybody, make sure you're subscribing to this show because you get a dose of Liberty education Monday through Friday. And this week, as always, we got David Stockman coming back on. We're going to talk about all kinds of things with him. We've got Michael Humer coming back on tomorrow. Talk about the rest of his book. That guy, that book, The Problem of Political Authority, what a great book that is. Absolutely devastating to every argument for the state you've ever heard. We're going to bring him back on, talk more about that. So much coming up. So subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so you don't miss an episode. You can do that over at TomWoodsRadio.com. I have talked enough, everybody. Go read some Rothbard. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.